name is Anjana Nagarajan Bhutani, and I am so excited to talk with Dr. Abraham Verghese today. Dr. Verghese is an American physician, author, and professor of the theory and practice of medicine and vice chair of education at Stanford University Medical School. His latest and long-awaited book, The Covenant of Water, is topping the bestseller lists. It is a sweeping family saga that will capture your imagination with both its storytelling as well as the richness of the language and imagery. The story follows a family for three generations in Kerala that harbors a secret. Let's get started.
Happy birthday, first and foremost.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you for spending this morning with me. I have to tell you, I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I wish my mom was alive to tell her about this, because I have roots in Kerala too. I was born in Kottayam.
Oh, you were? Wow. Your name doesn't suggest it, you know?
Yeah. My mother's family is Tamilian, but they'd been in Kerala for generations. So uh-huh. She's born and raised in Kottayam, and, you know, I was born in Kottayam, and I used to go for my summer vacations there.
Wow. Yeah.
So where is your family from?
So my mother's family is from near Maraman, you know, Koringeri, Thiruvella, that area. Uh-huh. Far. And my father's family from Manar, where Paramela Church is, you know, yeah.
That's awesome. Where did you spend your summers when you were a kid? You were used to go both homes?
My mom's parents' house. So
yeah,
both grandparents, but mostly my mom's parents. Yeah.
Okay. I've absolutely loved all your books. I've read them all multiple times. This book reads like an ode to your love of medicine, the way you love to practice medicine, your love of literature. But they also say geography is destiny. Do you believe that? You know, you grew up in Africa, you lived in the US, you studied in India, and you have your deep roots in a small community that's tightly knit in Kerala. How do you think geography and your identity shaped you?
Yeah, I think I think the best example is my own family. So, you know, my parents were born in Kerala, educated there, but they came of age with their college degrees just as India became independent from Britain. There were no jobs there, and so separately, they answered this ad for jobs in Ethiopia and landed up there, and that changed their destiny completely. We would all not be so many far-flung places if India had been able to accommodate all our aspirations and our ambitions. And then because I was born in Africa, I think my destiny was completely different from theirs. And then at a certain point, my parents moved first to America and I moved many years later, but it was in moving that my destiny completely changed. And I moved because my education in Ethiopia was interrupted by civil war, by the medical school. And then I eventually finished in India. And I can see all those continents that I've lived in leaving their unique stamp on me, and in many ways informing this novel also, you know. So also I should add that, you know, when you write a novel, one of the biggest decisions is where do you set it? Because I think geography imposes its destiny, if you like, on the narrative. So you set a story in Pasadena or you set a story in Kottayam, it's going to be a very different set of rules that the characters have to live by. So I think that's the sense in which I believe geography is destiny. And I think it's Napoleon who first said that, but lots of people have used that.
So you alluded to it a little bit, but how did you get started with the book? What was the genesis? Did the research guide you? Did you have a story in your head, and did it take it life of its own? I assume you had to do tons of research.
Yeah, I think. I think the first thing is after I had written my previous novel, which was set in Ethiopia, where I felt some authority, being able, you know, some confidence, being able to write about my childhood home. Even though ethnically I was not Ethiopian, so to speak, I felt it. I felt I was. With this book, I think the biggest decision was where to set it. And I had hesitated setting a novel in India because, again, I wasn't born and didn't grow up there. I'm very familiar with it from summer vacations and then later in medical school, but it's not quite the same thing as growing up and thinking in Malayalam, you know?
And
so it was really seeing a document that my mother had written. My five-year-old niece asked my mother, "What was it like, Amichi, when you were a little girl?" And my mother was so taken by that question because, you know, here she was in her 70s then, trying to describe to a five-year-old what it was like in a village without electricity or water. And yet that wasn't a deprivation. You know, actually, as a child, I thought it was magical to see, you know, the glow of lamplight all over the house. It was much prettier than the harshness of electricity when it came. So my mom began to write these series of anecdotes about our community and her childhood, and illustrating it with little sketches of, you know, common objects and dresses. And in revisiting that document, even though those stories didn't really pop up in my book, it was just a reminder of the richness of any community, but our community, because it's the one I know, you know, the richness of this tradition of faith from St. Thomas the Apostle in 52 AD. And yet it's a faith whose rituals have a lot of Hindu traditions that have still been retained. And then the desire to stay within that community that results in, you know, remarriages and all the premium that's placed on the reputation of a family. So it had all the elements of a good place to set a story. And I think if I hesitated, it was because I didn't know it quite as well as someone who's native born. But I tried to make up for that with a lot of research and by enlisting the help of, you know, wonderful experts who had that authority. And they weren't necessarily writers, but they had the authority that they could inform someone like me trying to write about it. So that's really how it came about.
In a story this long, I mean, how do you break it down into chapters? Did you name chapters first? Did you write the story and then break it down into chapters?
Yeah, I mean, I to answer what you had asked me just before, I remember now, I only had the geography.
Okay.
And I had a sense that I wanted this to be a family over several generations. I'm drawn to those kinds of stories. I always feel like stories are instructions for living, and it's only in the span of three generations that you get the kind of wisdom that you're seeking. I mean, not always, but I'm drawn to that. And I also had early on that the family would carry an inherited condition that would be passed on. Because, you know, it's always fascinated me how in medicine you have, even today, we have things that we have a label for, but we don't understand. And in 70 years, that label will be replaced by something much more accurate. So I love the idea of having this conceit run through the novel of a inherited condition that gets ultimately unraveled by the sweep of time, nothing else, you know. So I didn't really have, I mean, I wish I had an outline of everything that was going to happen. And I envy the writers who do. And I actually had a whiteboard on which I sketched out the whole novel. But the thing is, you start writing and the character develops, and then you put the character under pressure. So one of the maxims or axioms of writing is that characters are defined by the decisions they take under pressure. I would put this character under pressure, and they would sort of let me know that that's not what they were going to do. What I had planned for them wasn't what they would do, and I knew it.
Right.
I'd have to change direction. And so I think a lot of things like chapter headings and the way the book is segmented comes much, much later in the process. When you finally see the whole thing, then you can start to shape it, you know.
In the book, when Koshi Sar introduces literature to Philippos, is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He says, fiction is the greatest lie that tells the truth about the world we live in, the world, how the world lives. It struck a chord in me because my husband mostly reads nonfiction, and my daughter, when she was in high school, like challenged her dad to read a piece of fiction every month because she says it builds empathy and teaches you how the world works.
Exactly. Good for her.
So, and now he's still continuing. How do you view your dual worlds of writing and practicing medicine? Does doing one make you better at the other? Why do you think it's important to read fiction?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I think I always find it remarkable that we are educated by stories when we grow up. You're a serious kind of person. Uncle Tom's Cabin, if you heard of this book, it changed America. It ended slavery. Not a politician, not an army, but one book captured the public's imagination. Or The Citadel in the UK. That book, a fictional book about medical conditions in a small Welsh mining town, that caused the National Health Service to be born, you know? So I think fiction is terribly important to, just as your daughter said, to increase your empathy, your imagination. You know, our lived lives are so narrow, and the only way to walk in someone else's shoes is to, you know, buy the vehicle of something like a book. Mm-hmm. So when we want to teach end of life in medicine, you know, we could point someone to a palliative care textbook, or if you want them to really feel it, you point them to The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy, you know, really story that makes you feel what it's like to suddenly get a death sentence. Or if you want to teach child abuse, you point them to, you know, the novel, The Bastard Out of Carolina by Dorothy Allison, where you will feel what child abuse is like. It's just amazing. So, yeah, I've always subscribed to the fact that fiction is important. But the fact is, you get into medicine and it's so technical, it's so left brain that your right brain can atrophy. I find that for me, that to answer the second part of your question, the practice of medicine, the art of looking at patients and trying to gather from their story, make something special out of it, or gather facts from their body, reading the body, these are all the same skills I bring to writing. You're sort of using the same lens, at least I am. So it's not two different hats. I'm using the same lens as I approach a story and the characters. And I think that, you know, the skills of medicine don't hurt you when you're in writing. But conversely, I think the writing often helps me process the medical stuff that I'm seeing, you know, especially nonfiction. So I've always had the sense that if I'm assigned a piece of nonfiction to write about, I can go walk by the river and flesh it out in my mind, but there's something utterly mysterious when you sit down to write, as you know, comes out can be completely different than what planned. And so I feel like I'm writing in order to understand what I'm thinking. So that's how writing and medicine sort of feed on each other.
Yeah. As a person who's mostly lived outside India, and especially as a man, how did you get into the mind of a young girl at 12 who gets married and learns how to cook and mango season and cooking with clay pots and, you know, how to make a good fish curry? I mean, how did you get into that mindset of a young woman who's learning to become into her own?
Yeah, it's a tremendous question. I think, first of all, I had a great amount of help from my cousins and friends, you know, who were helpful with those very questions. But I think I had as my model my grandmother, who married at a very young age and, you know, came into this household and never left till she died. You know, that was her world. Who, as mothers, are flawed, or as mothers are evil, or, you know. And I really wanted to pay tribute to the quiet heroism of these Amichis, you know, who the world will never know about them. And in their lifetime, their influence on their children to make them take advantage of opportunities they never had, the stability they bring, the faith they bring, the way they cobble this all together, you know, there's something so admirable about that quality. And so I knew that I wanted to describe that. And I, you know, talked to a lot of my mother, my aunts, my cousins to get at the nitty-gritty of that experience, you know.
I guess your mother's life didn't play as much of a part as your grandmother's did.
Yeah, so, I think my mother was clearly outside of India for the great part, but she remembered so much about her childhood and could explain lots of details to me. But there's also an abundance of historical material that I was able to search, both in the anthropology literature, but also in individual narratives and, you know, oral histories. There's just a richness out there, you know.
So, Are you a man of faith? Does it play a part in your practice of medicine, and especially in your writing of the character of Amichi? How were you able to pepper the story naturally, organically, with her Bible sayings and the way she talks?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I personally am you know, an example of any kind of faithfulness. But, you know, the definition of faith is belief in the absence of proof, you know. And I think I was always moved by the fact that people like my grandmother and mother, you know, they just took this as something necessary. They never debated it the way our generation did. And as a consequence, it was a powerful force in their life, you know, something that...
So much strength.
Yeah, so much strength that you know, if you didn't embrace it the way they did, then you lack something, you know, you...
Mm-hmm.
And not necessarily embrace it quite as much as they have. And, you know, but I'm impressed with it. Like my father, I happen to be recording this from Boston, where I'm at my brother's house. My father, who's 97, lives here. And on Saturday night, he was watching the church service from the church where he went to as a little boy, where his father was a deacon, where he became a deacon. His father's buried, his brother's buried. He was married in that church, you know. So to, you know, to sort of see the depth of his association, that church, that service, that congregation, even though he's a continent away, I was terribly moved by that. And I think in my writing, I'm not trying to proselytize or, you know, bring people to faith or away from faith, but I'm trying to celebrate the richness of the faith that whatever it is, whatever faith it is that people have, and also the degree of empowerment it brings to people who truly subscribe to it, you know, whatever the faith is. And that's all I was doing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and it always struck me in India that irrespective of what your religious faith is, the average person's depth of faith is very strong. When my mom is in the hospital, people will just stop by and say, I'm praying for her. You know, the nurses will say it, the peons in the office. Yeah. And it's just natural. They're not faking it.
Exactly. You know?
And there is a beauty in that, I mean, it's hard for me because I'm always, like you said, questioning everything.
Yeah.
But I wish I had that.
Yeah. Exactly. And as a physician, when a patient is in, has a serious illness and has a strong faith, my sense is that they have a better support system for what lies ahead. And oftentimes it is unimaginable how much they can draw on that to face whatever it is, be it chemo or even the prospect of immediate death. You know, it's
right.
Powerful for them. So it's something that I've always thought is beneficial when you have it, but it's certainly not the doctor's role to try and impose it on you, you know?
I thought it was interesting how Digby, as a Catholic Scot who couldn't, you know, live fully his life in Scotland, had to gain surgical knowledge by joining the Indian Medical Service. Is that kind of reflect your medical path in the US?
I hadn't thought about that in that fashion. I think it was true of the time. So there were many physician types from the UK who joined the Indian Medical Service in part because doors were closed for them in the UK, but also because this was a great opportunity for them to really build their skills. You know, the parallel with my experience in the US is slightly different, but I think very relevant to your readers. Every year, thousands of physicians from abroad come to America, and they come only because there's a need. Without that annual influx, all the residency programs in inner city hospitals, you know, would simply not survive, because America has found this very cost-effective way to provide good care to indigent patients through training programs in county hospitals, especially inner city county hospitals. But you enter at a second level. This is the only place you can apply to. You really can't be applying to anywhere else. And if you make your way to some other elite institution, it'll be down the road after so-called, you know, paying your dues, and the field is more level when you specialize. But it never entirely goes away, so that, you know, the average American patient has no idea why there are so many foreign physicians. But it's like anything else in America. If America has a need, people around the world provide, whether it's basketball players or porn detasslers or, you know,
IT workers.
Yeah, whatever you need, gig workers and IT workers, the world provides. And so in that sense, I think there are some parallels with Digby.
Your book takes us on a journey of great change in Kerala for over three generations. And you allude to some of the changes that are not so good, like opium and toddy, but talk a little bit more about communism. Why do you think communism took such a stronghold in Kerala? The same oppression of the lower castes happened in all across the country, but especially also the states around it. But what is in the psyche of a Malayali that you think that is different, that they took to communism with such fervor?
Yeah, not just Kerala, but in Bengal as well.
Bengal too, yeah.
I think it's clearly related, not just to the experience of oppression, which was universal, mm-hmm. but to literacy. So the moment you could have people who were put upon, but who could also find ways for their suffering to be articulated by others that they could then read and identify with, you know. I mean, it's amazing. Communism in Kerala often was based on a document by Stalin, who no one would think of as the, only because that was the one thing translated into Malayalam and copied repeatedly and in every jail. So they would say you went into jail as a drunkard and you came out a communist, you know?
Exactly.
But I really think literacy had a great deal to do with it. And the fact that, you know, there were intellectuals of the upper class who really empathized with the downtrodden and, you know, made it a point to bring that literature to the people whom it affected. That was very, very potent, I think.
What is your allegory for the title of the book? I have many theories, including the geography of Kerala, but I'm curious why you chose the title. To me, it has, it's an ode to your Christianity and your faith. I mean, the day it hit me the most, because I saw it in many places, is when the day Big Amachi dies and she has a bath before her bed, and she talks about, you know, this water that is your covenant with you, with your soil. And, you know, even when we sin, then we're born again day after day through this water.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes through in so many ways, the title of your book, throughout the story. But what, did you have a central theme? Did you come up with the name of the book afterwards?
It was afterwards. I had a working title before that. I think that I have always believed that titles should be a bit mysterious, that you should, you know, and the author doesn't necessarily have the explanation. So my theory is that of writing in general is that, you know, the writer provides the words, the reader provides their imagination. Somewhere in middle space in the reader's head is this unique fictional mental movie is happening. And that movie is very different from one reader to another. Each one has their own movie.
Absolutely.
Which is why when you go to the movie version of the book, then you're always disappointed because what you had in mind. But for the same reason, I think titles can echo in different ways for different readers. I actually wasn't thinking formally of, you know, Christianity when I use the word covenant, because it's a very much an Old Testament term. So it's very much in the Jewish culture and, you know, anywhere else. And that element of water, you know, renewing in water, baptizing water, is true of Christianity, but it's also true of, you know, many other religions. You wash your feet before you go in. Yeah, at one level, covenant also represented this family's covenant to keep this secret condition secret, you know. So there were levels and levels of what covenant could have meant, you know. And I think a reader can take their pick. I don't have the key.
Later in the book, when Mariamma goes to college and Big Amachi says to her, "I'm always with you, even when I'm long gone, you carry my name." This made me stop and think, because, you know, we all have a culture, in every culture, of naming our children after our ancestors. And I always thought of it as kind of like vanity and in many cases patriarchy. But now I read that and I thought, huh, maybe it's got to do with blessings, that you always then carry the blessings of, you know, your grandparents or great-grandparents. And I thought, I mean, how do you think about it?
It's interesting. Until you said that, I never quite thought of it that way. You know, I thought it's vanity as well, you know.
Yeah.
Tradition or, you know. But, you know, I carry my grandfather's name and, you know, I never thought about this. But, you know, in a way, it's a very symbolic way of carrying this legacy forward. Yeah. I never thought about that. So, you know, very often the readers give me more credit for
But like
planning
you
all
said,
this.
right? Like we come to it with our views of life,
Exactly, yeah.
The stories we've told ourselves, and sometimes we see things that we want to see.
And they're not incorrect. I mean, I've been sent master's thesis by people expounding on the previous book, Cutting for Stone, on what my theme was, what my political, you know, and I always think, wow, if only I had that kind of genius
vision.
to plan all that. But it's not incorrect. I mean, I don't ever argue with that, because if the reader took away that, then that's true for them.
Yeah.
It's not for me to say that it's not there. You know, I can only say that my goal is always very simple: a good story, well told. That's what I'm trying for. And everything else that happens in the process is a byproduct of that thing, you know. If I'm trying to push forward a political theme, then it becomes a polemic, it becomes, you know, too much expository writing, and you lose the reader. You lose the reader.
I mean, that's why a good story stands the test of time, right? And we still argue or what somebody meant in this story or how can it be interpreted now, because a good story can always be a good story. In the end, when the truth comes out, and they say the great lie that tells the truth is revealed, and what defines a family is not blood but secrets, do you think this is the genesis of any good story?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I call it secret. Other people can call it conflict and resolution, you know. I do think, I mean, you really can't have a story where nothing's happening. There's always something at stake, something to be revealed, something to be obtained. But to me, secrets was a particularly potent thing in the life of that community because, you know, arranged marriages are such that the slightest thing that taints a girl's or boy's reputation, usually more the girl than the boy, is enough to change your whole fortunes, you know? So, I think that once I latched on to the idea of this being a secret, and then I began to sort of expand on that.
What? Why did you bring the elephant Damodaran into the story? What was your thought behind his coming and going?
Yeah. Not quite sure, except that, you know, it was such an integral part of my childhood to see.
Absolutely. The temple elephant used to come to our house and court him.
Yeah. You know, they're such striking creatures. And I always thought that they had a very human quality to them, especially into their eye. The eye was so beautiful and rich and
gentle.
Gentle. And they seem to be slowed down humans, you know, and the ubiquity of the god image of Ganesha, you know. Mm-hmm. So it felt like a very real character to me. And I just liked the idea of running with it to the point where he has this major role in the family, you know?
Yeah, it was interesting to me because elephant mothers are amazing mothers. So, but you made Damodaran a male elephant.
Yeah, yeah.
So connected to both Amachi and her husband. So, you know.
And I actually, I'm trying, but I don't want to insist the readers see this, to have Bigamaji think that her husband is now in the elephant, you know, that in a way, especially in the way the elephant acts with Philippos, the next generation.
Exactly.
He has come to being in there, you know.
Your book is over 700 pages long and already topping bestseller lists. In this day and age where everybody, even people my age or our age, have such low attention span, what do you think captivates the human spirit for the love of a good storytelling? And what does it mean for content creators when everybody's trying to break the 30-second capture dilemma, you know?
Oh, honestly, I was worried because, you know, it's a big concern for publishers, for booksellers, and the amount of space it occupies and the price of the book. But I had a brilliant editor, and Peter Blackstock, who also edited Shuggie Bain and Sympathizer. I mean, at one point he said, you know, a book needs to be as long as it needs to be. And we never discussed length. We were only talking about the story. And I find it very gratifying to see the way the book's being picked up. To me, I hope this means that the pendulum is swinging back, because I think as a nation of short attention spans, it's really
the world of short attention span.
It's worrying. And you know, I think if this is a trend that people suddenly realize, I mean, the most satisfying feedback I've been getting from strangers is, I looked ahead to see how many pages I had left, and I was disappointed that I only had 200 pages left. And in other words, they wanted it to continue, you know?
Right.
So if it's a good story, the length shouldn't matter. And if you find yourself trying to read to finish, then, you know, something's missing there. So,
question about medicine. When Mariama starts college in the 68, a third of her class was women, which was normal in India, but unheard of in the United States at that time. Mm-hmm. Even when I came to college here in the 80s to study engineering, there were more women going to study engineering in India than here. Do you have any thoughts on that? And why do you think that is? It's changed now, but...
Well, it's surprising. I mean, I think that...
And you said your mother by herself went to Ethiopia.
Exactly right, yeah.
Was it the 50s?
It would have been the late 40s.
Late 40s. I mean, think of her courage, right?
Yeah. I think it's because... unless the parents held them back, the opportunities were the same for men and women, you know, in the professions and the education. Also, it helped that certain medical schools like Vellore were all women. It was only a woman's medical school, and then it began to let in men. So I'm not sure why that was. I think it's also because there was a time when obstetricians and gynecologists had to be
women.
And, you know, so there was more of a sense of the importance of that. Yeah, but it is puzzling. In fact, my editors pushed back here saying, is that right? I mean, that many women in that era? I said, yeah, that's absolutely right, you know?
Congratulations. I loved your book. I've read it twice already. And probably, we'll read it again in another year when I'll get something else out of it. But good luck, and can't wait to read your next book.
What a pleasure to talk to you. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anjana. I appreciate it.